Questions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI. We're a socialist radio show and podcast. We're members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000 plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. In 1997, nearly 200,000 Teamsters went on strike against UPS, fighting for a fair contract. They fought for a better contract, and they won. Will the American labor movement experience another massive strike at UPS led by the Teamsters in 2023? Matt joins us to discuss that and much more. But first, the headlines.
I'm Lisa Shi, and these are your headlines for Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. The New York Housing Authority warned residents of the Jacob Riis houses in the East Village to not drink the tap water, as tests revealed it contained high levels of arsenic. The results were known by NYCHA managers for 2 weeks prior to them being released to residents. Arrests for low-level crimes like fare evasion and petty theft have risen by 25% under Mayor Adams, the first such increase in a decade. The Court of Appeals may have broken the law in its selection of an interim replacement for outgoing chief Janet DeFiore, allowing her to improperly select her successor. The City Council is considering a bill to outlaw 24-hour shifts for home care workers after a similar bill failed at the state level. The Brooklyn Democratic Party diluted the power of county committee members in an effort to consolidate power around Chair Ranis Bechet-Hermelin, who faced questions about her leadership. With e-bike subsidies left out of federal climate legislation, the state legislature may take up the issue next year. City workers' vacancy rate has quadrupled since the pandemic to 8%, as the city fails to compete with private and nonprofit sectors' willingness to offer flexible work options. Data collected by the United States Geological Survey shows the areas in dire need for greater flood protection. Those areas include Park Slope, Gowanus, Bushwick, Williamsburg, Woodside, and Jackson Heights, among others. And in election news, city and state covered the successes of DSA and other statewide progressives in the August primary. The 2022 primary saw mixed results for the Working Families Party. There will be four ballot proposals for New York City voters to vote on in November. And last night, State Assembly member Yulee Niu ended speculations, saying she will not run against Daniel Goldman in the New York 10 general election after narrowly losing to Goldman in the primary. She will not run on the Working Families Party line. A lawsuit filed by conservatives to block New York City efforts to gain the right to vote in local elections to non-citizens is citing the words of several members of the Adams administration, including ex-councilmember Lori Cumbo, who alleged the expanding the right to vote is racist. I'm Lisa Shi, and now back to the studio.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. Hey, Matt, how's it going? Thank you so much for joining us on RPM.
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the subject of today's discussion, the Teamsters, the potential, the organizing that's happening at UPS and the potential strike that could happen next year, I want to get in a little bit of your background. So what social forces propelled you into the movement for socialism? Why did you join DSA in particular, and what kind of organizing have you been involved with?
totally. Well, I would say the main social forces that got me involved with socialism in particular, it really had to do with just after finishing school and realizing that I had to get a job and that that was going to be basically what my life was going to be like for the remainder of my years until retirement. And just sort of reckoning with the fact that, like, I have to choose something that is going to be fulfilling and satisfying. And I really didn't know where to look for that. But at the same time, Bernie, you know, was kicking off his campaign for 2020. And when I was just sort of volunteering for his campaign on the weekends, I felt like, wow, this kind of work actually feels fulfilling. I'd like to spend more of my time doing something, you know, related to this kind of work. And so I joined DSA around that time because it was mainly DSA-led canvases that I was participating in for Bernie, and it made sense to join. And then I started to get involved in some of the more, like, political education kind of stuff around that. So that's really how I got involved in DSA.
So you hit on a number of themes that we've heard from guests on the show before and kind of just paint a picture of the reality that we live in, the social reality. Capitalism propels you to have to get a job. You have to work, you have to earn a living, and you're trying to figure out a way to do this. And for you, the solution was, hey, I can work on political campaigns. But there was, at this moment, there was a political campaign happening that connected with your vision for a better world, the what you wanted to fight for, what you were hoping to see the United States transformed into being. And that's what the Bernie Sanders campaign offered. I think it offered that to a lot of people. We have a lot of people who come on the show that were attracted to socialism because of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think that's the case for a lot of people in DSA. And you saw DSA as a vehicle, an organization that was building and growing in the wake of this Sanders campaign and all these other struggles that are happening around it. And I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we are talking about the Teamsters at UPS and the potential, the organizing that's happening there, potential strike that's going to happen. But first, we want to dig into a little bit of history. So, Matt, what happened in 1997? How does that strike relate to the struggles facing Teamsters working at UPS today? And what has changed in that in the time since?
Totally. Well, so in 1997, UPS Teamsters went on strike. And this, you know, was a very big deal to the extent that, you know, Bill Clinton had to get involved. It really shut the country down in a big way. Another aspect of that strike that was, I think, really that's important to note is the fact that it was led by Ron Carey, who was the president of the Teamsters at that time. And he was actually the first democratically elected president of the Teamsters Union. And so it really represented kind of like an uprising, you know, of these workers. There had been a lot of like corruption in the Teamsters Union for decades before this strike had happened, and the federal government almost trusteed the union in the late 80s, early 90s, but instead the Teamsters got the right to vote. They voted in their first democratically elected leader, and then a few years later, they actually organized this massive strike and won. And so that, I would say that that relates to the struggles facing Teamsters working at UPS today. I mean, we've had democratic elections since Ron Carey, but the last 23 years before Teamsters United was elected was really kind of marked by these concessionary contracts and leadership under actually Jimmy Hoffa's son, James Hoffa. And so we're seeing a new era in the Teamsters right now. We just elected the Teamsters United slate under President Sean O'Brien, and there's a lot of kind of detail I can get into here, but there's basically been a sort of reclaiming of the union from the rank and file that's happened in the last couple years, because of this really concessionary contract that was actually forced down membership's throat by Hoffa in 2018. And so we've got new leadership at the helm that's been really speaking on behalf of rank and file members of the Teamsters across the country, and speaking in such a way that we really might see 1997 replay itself, but of course in much different, I would say, you know, economic and historic conditions. What has changed? I mean, in 1997, the state of the American left was much, much weaker. There was no organization like DSA, you know, with like 95,000 members nationally that would be sort of ready and available to support this kind of strike. There were no sort of like major figures in American politics like someone like Bernie Sanders, who has politics that lean in this direction, who was also really going to be, I think, a very supportive voice in this contract campaign. At the same time, we're seeing levels of, you know, wealth inequality that are even higher than they were in 1997. UPS is making historic profits. There's more competition, actually, in the industry with not just FedEx, but now Amazon, which is a huge threat to Teamster jobs in the industry. So I think that we're seeing, and on top of that, with the pandemic, there's been a lot of stress on supply chain, which is, of course, what we are, you know, working with and sort of participating in every day as UPS drivers and warehouse workers, et cetera. There's been a lot of stress on supply chains, a lot of expectation from workers, who are working in the supply chain. And so I think that conditions are kind of a lot more polarized and intense today in a way that they weren't in 1997. And so I think that if there is going to be a strike at UPS, I think it's really going to kind of shake things up even more than it may have back then.
You hit on a number of crucial points, and I just want to expand. First of all, building off what you're saying about 1997, this is a major strike, and you bring up supply chains. UPS is critical within the supply chain. It's delivering goods to people all across the country. It's delivering goods to businesses. So a strike by workers at UPS hold immense power. They can shut down major parts of industry. They can bring capital to a halt in a certain sense, at least at a single, not just at a single company, but companies that are connected to this company. So the power of the workers at UPS is beyond just the relationship they have with the owners of UPS, but it's to the capitalist economy as a whole. So they have immense leverage in this fight. But as you're saying, the conditions have shifted in a number of ways. You have increased competition within the industry. So as you're saying, there's not just FedEx, but Amazon, this behemoth. And we'll talk more later in the show about organizing at Amazon and how this can be connected to organizing that's going on with the Teamsters at UPS, how workers at Amazon and UPS can unite together in this in a front to struggle against capital. But you also have these shifting conditions politically. You have, and you were involved in the campaign, and I think many of our listeners have been involved in the campaign and involved in voting for socialists. You have this socialist movement that is growing. It's getting people elected. We just, DSA just got Christine Gonzalez elected in Queens. So I think you have a growing movement, a growing socialist movement that can be supportive of UPS strike. You also have conditions where the presidential administration is being pulled in a direction not necessarily, there's right-wing forces that are pushing against Joe Biden, but Joe Biden's presidency is very different than Bill Clinton's presidency. Bill Clinton is cutting deals with Republicans to slash welfare, to deregulate finance. So you have the momentum is in the direction of neoliberalism at that point. While with the Biden administration, it's much more contested. You have an NLRB that is siding with workers in a number of key decisions. And also you have organizing happening on the ground. You have organizing, as I mentioned, at Amazon, happening at Starbucks, happening at Chipotle, at Apple stores, and seeing if we can connect these various movements together. But you also are hinting at a key thing, which is the internal politics of the union. And so can you just explain to our listeners again, what are the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, and how has the change in leadership reshaped the Teamsters?
Totally, yes. Yeah. So Teamsters for a Democratic Union is a rank-and-file-led caucus within the Teamsters Union. And they've been around for decades now, and really they were formed to fight corruption in the union. And so they, when you look at like the conditions of the international, like at, and in locals, but if you look at conditions in the union, like compared to when Teamsters for Democratic Union was founded, a lot of the work that they've done, we've already seen a lot of victories kind of come out of the work that they've done. I mean, the one member, one vote was something that they played a large part in fighting for. But now, especially with the Teamsters United slate elected, that's also a slate that was endorsed by TDU. And so when you look at the history of TDU decades ago, you know, like members of the organization were getting threatened, thrown out of, you know, union events and stuff like that. And now we're at a point where we've built enough power within the union to actually have kind of like a seat at the table in terms of international leadership. And they're still doing a lot of important work reforming a lot of these kind of old locals that have grown stagnant over time and haven't necessarily sort of like updated with the status of the international. But the sort of role that TDU has played over time has changed as they've, you know, been more and more successful reforming and making the union more democratic. And so the Teamsters United slate is this leadership slate that I was speaking about earlier that was elected in November of 2021 and finally took office in March of this year. And I would say that so far what we can see in terms of how this leadership has reshaped the Teamsters, it's hard to make any, you know, I guess like serious claims because they still have only been in office for like a few months. They're speaking very militantly about sort of like this upcoming contract campaign. However, though, I've also only been a member for about 2 years, and so I wasn't actually around for the last contract campaign, so I can't really speak to the sort of details about how this time looks compared to last time. However, I've heard that things are a lot more together in terms of organizing for the contract. I've also heard that the way that they're doing negotiations is, I think it's starting a little bit later. I believe that they're doing supplemental negotiations before they're doing the national negotiations. But I think that time will tell sort of in terms of how the union's actually going to be reshaped. That's even though that we have like a new sort of like international leadership, it's going to take time to see it fully reshaped.
You say you've been a member for the past 2 years. Did you play any role in the recent elections and getting the Teamsters United slate elected?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a lot of like flyering outside of buildings, not just my own, but at buildings, even in some other locals. I would like basically volunteer time to do a lot of flyering like that, mainly in like New Jersey and in New York.
That's great work. I mean, I think that's a way to spread the message and connect people to the campaign to transform the union. And I think what we're seeing with the Teamsters, and the Teamsters have this complicated and very powerful history. You can throw it back to the Teamsters in 1934 being crucial players in the Minneapolis, what amounted to basically a general strike there, and a key strike that shut down the city, showed the power of workers, and was one of the key strikes in the pushing forward the second New Deal. So it scared not just the bosses, but capital and the state as a whole into pushing forward reforms, labor law reforms, building out the welfare state, building out workers' rights in various ways. And so we had this major strike going on in 1934 that the Teamsters were involved in. The Teamsters also used some interesting tactics, including violence, in Detroit in the 1930s and 40s in order to unionize warehouses and get drivers on their side. So they were fighting fire with fire. Capital was fighting back intensely and was trying to maintain control of the workplace. And you saw the Teamsters engage and directly challenge this and confront this. But you also have this history, as you mentioned, of corruption. There's been corruption in the union. The Hoffa leadership was at times potentially tied to the mob. And so you had the Teamsters cutting deals that maybe were not always working on behalf of the workers or for worker power, but were for interests behind the scenes. So you have this very complex history of the Teamsters where they've demonstrated worker power, they've fought for a better society, but there's also been this history of corruption. So Teamsters for a Democratic Union and the Teamsters United seems like it's pushing, building off the worker empowerment aspects of the legacy. It's a building for a stronger union, a more militant union, a more democratic union. And I'm very curious how this will play out. Do you have any reflections on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just generally what we're seeing is a moment where the rank and file of the union is really taking charge. And I think that it's really also, you can see it sort of reflected in just broader political conditions as well, where like, I mean, I think it's significant that, for example, Sean O'Brien has been doing a lot of, he's been doing rallies with Bernie Sanders. He spoke alongside Bernie Sanders at the Labor Notes, conference in, I think that was in June. He recently spoke with Bernie and also Sarah Nelson from the flight attendants union. There was a weekend with two rallies in Philadelphia and in Boston called the working class. I mean, he's really, building this alliance with a broader, left, pro-labor, political movement. One that's really inspired by one that, has been sort of dubbed as populist in certain, political spheres. I mean, Bernie is a left populist. And I think that in a way, a labor leader who is really reflecting the rank and file can kind of be you can kind of describe him in a similar light. So I think we're seeing the alliance of these kind of left, pro-labor populist leaders, both in the broader sort of political sphere with Bernie, and seeing that same sort of condition reflected within the Teamsters union as well. And I think that that's an exciting trend. It's really, a kind of moment where people are riled up and sort of and tired of, the way that things are. So, that kind of took it out of the Teamsters, but,
Well, no, absolutely. It's an incredibly encouraging development, seeing these rallies and these events where you have Democratic Socialist politicians like Bernie Sanders with labor leaders like Sean O'Brien and Sarah Nelson, Chris Smalls, bringing these various leaders and these movements together, because we have a history in the United States where there's been separation between the socialist movement and the labor movement. And with the Socialist Party and the AFL. They were at odds. They were disconnected. They weren't working together to build a labor party, a political party that represented the working class. And so what you're hopefully seeing here is the building of organization, the fusion of these movements, these leaders that are representing hundreds of thousands, millions of workers, with politicians who are the voice of millions of people and receive millions of votes in presidential primaries, that you're seeing power be fused and grow, and a real movement emerging. Now, there's real questions about will we see the strike numbers increase like we did in different eras, like the 1930s, 60s, and 70s, or will we actually see unionization increase like we did in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where it was up to 35% in the private sector. We're at a point where it's around 6% in the private sector. We still have powerful public sector unions and some powerful private sector unions like the Teamsters at UPS, but we'll be able to grow the movement to include more and more workers, so more and more workers have organizations representing and fighting for them out in the streets, at the workplace, and all across the country. But I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we are talking about the Teamsters organizing at UPS, the history of the Teamsters, including the 1997 strike, whether they're going to go on strike in 2023, the current fights for a fair contract with UPS, and much more. But before we do that, I just want to talk to the listeners about supporting this show and supporting the station. This station is at a desperate point. It needs money in order to keep going, in order to have content like this, where we can have a Teamster on the air talking about their participation in the elections to change the union, to make it a more democratic union, to make it a union that's fighting more for its members and not accepting concessions and contracts. We can have a show on the air that's talking about labor history, the struggles of the working class, the movement for democratic socialism. It's important that you come on, that you support this station in any way you can. I know it's tough times for people economically, but I'm sure there's some listeners that have a little extra dough. And there's a few ways you can do that. You can go to WBAI, become a BAI buddy with a show. That means you give a monthly donation. It could be $5, $10. And you say, oh, I really like the show. I like the show Revolutions Per Minute. I want to say that this is my show. I want to give a donation, a recurring donation, and do it that way. Or you can call the station at 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. And you can donate that way. You can give a donation via phone call, or you can just go to WBAI.org and give a one-time donation. It's crucial in a time like this where we have vicious right-wing media and figures like Tucker Carlson spreading brutal, barbaric propaganda on the airwaves, demonizing workers, demonizing the racialized population in the United States, demonizing immigrants, that we need voices for the people who are fighting for a better world, who are fighting for a more democratic world, that are fighting for a world that the working class is empowered. And that's what we do here at WBAI. So please go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. All right, Matt, let's get back to our conversation about the Teamsters. So what are the Teamsters' demand in the struggle for a fair contract with UPS? What tactics have the union members utilized thus far in the fight? Could there be a strike in 2023? And what would that mean for the American labor movement?
Yeah, so the main demands in the next contract, that there's a number of them. I would say one of the main ones, which is connected to one of the things that O'Brien and the Teamsters United Plate campaigned on, is this two-tier driver situation that was created in the last 2018 contract, and it's the issue that it's this language in the contract that basically created a two-tier driver system with different pay and less rights. And this contract was actually voted down by the majority of members who voted. But there was basically a bylaw in the Constitution that stated that if less than a majority of the members actually vote and less than two-thirds of the number of voters vote no, then the principal officer actually has the right to veto the way that members vote. And so that's what Hoffa did. He invoked the two-thirds rule and forced this contract down membership throat, which had this two-tier driver job called the 22-4, because it was in Article 22, Section 4 of the contract. And so this was an incredibly unpopular move on Hoffa's part, but it was basically, you know, it was done to, like, avert something like a strike. And so in O'Brien's campaign, one of the main issues that was brought up in the campaign was ending the 22-4 two-tier driver situation at UPS. And so that's definitely been something that he's called a strike issue, basically for as long as he's been running his campaign. There's also a big issue of part-time pay at UPS, and that's another one of the most important issues that we're seeing. Part-timers at UPS are getting paid, just above minimum wage in a state like New York. They're getting something like, you know, $15 an hour, for, you know, something like 20 hours, a week. And this is really, really hard work that these workers are doing. And the hours are really tough. They're like, you know, starting at 4 in the morning, working 3.5 to 5 hours or something like that, and dealing with really heavy packages in warehouses that are not air conditioned and can get really, you know, cold in the winter time. And so it's really important that we raise those wages for the part-timers as well, so that they feel like they're a part of this union. And I think it's actually a majority of UPS employees who are part-timers. So it's really important that we get a strong contract for them, because they really make up a large part of this union. There's also an issue of subcontracting, I think particularly in theater. That's something I know a little bit, that's something I know less about, just because I'm not so close to that type of work. But I mean, I think it kind of speaks for itself. It's they're not using union labor in a lot of this work. They're subcontracting it. So that's definitely something that we want to fight. We want to keep all jobs union. A big issue, I mean, it's always been an issue, but something that's really sort of come to surface as a very popular issue has been the issue of air conditioning in trucks, especially during summer months. UPS trucks do not have air conditioning, and there's been a lot of heat stroke and even drivers dying in the summer months. And so getting air conditioning, or like basically increased heat safety, has been something that has surfaced as a big contract issue. And then, of course, there's always going to be fighting harassment and increasing surveillance that UPS uses a lot to basically gain leverage over workers. I would say that those are, from what I've seen, the main contract issues that we are looking at this point.
She had a contract. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I realized that there's a few more questions that you asked me.
Sorry, I threw a lot of questions your way, and you just gave a great answer. Don't want to overwhelm.
Should I continue?
Yeah, please continue.
Okay, cool. So what tactics have union members utilized thus far in the fight? Well, so we had a week of action that happened basically the first week of August, which was the 25-year anniversary of the 97 strike, as well as be basically year until contract expiration. So in other words, it's like a year before we might go on strike. And buildings all across the country had rallies, just, you know, demonstrating unity and showing power. And this was a really exciting opportunity for us to just come together and really, you know, start to make the possibility of this strike a reality. There's also, before we did that, in Local 804 in New York, we were setting up basically like strike funds. And that's through the Local 804 credit union. Basically, we were organizing to get members to sign up, basically to create like a safe or a savings account, to deduct money straight from your paycheck and basically like planning so that people have enough money saved, to be out of work for basically like 2 weeks, which is how long the strike lasted in 97. That's what we were suggesting to people. And so, you know, people's main concern when it comes to going on strike, of course, is not being able to put food on the table, not being able to pay their mortgage or their rent. So if we can get prepared financially a year in advance, then people are going to have, you know, a much greater incentive to actually stay strong on that picket line if it comes down to it. So we were organizing to set up that strike fund, and you know, there's a lot more that I can touch on, but I think that the main things that we're really doing right now are just stressing like the main issues, getting people set up financially, and just having conversations with people as much as we can about why preparing for a strike is the most is actually the best way that you can avert the strike. Because if we have a very credible strike threat, then the company could decide that, okay, we'll actually give them the contract that we want, that the workers want, and then we don't actually have to walk and be out of work without, you know, without pay for 2 weeks. So right now, the goal is to just get prepared. And could there be a strike in 2023? Ultimately, it's going to be up to the members. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. The two-thirds rule that HAFA used to force the 2018 contract was eradicated, actually, in the 2021 National Convention. And so at this point, it really is going to be up to the membership. If we get a contract and the majority of members vote no, then and there's no contract, then, you know, we're going to be in a position where we can authorize a strike and go on strike. It's really going to be up to the members. And so from what I've seen, O'Brien is also using some very, very strong language. I mean, he's literally said that he wants to pulverize UPS. He said that he wants to pulverize basically corporate America. And he's saying that, you know, basically like unionism is a full contact sport. He's really, you know, talking tough. And so, and I think that the members are in, you know, motivated by this, because we deal with so much harassment at work, that having this kind of like empowered speech around winning like a good contract, I think, is getting people very excited. I have a lot of coworkers who want to go on strike, you know, even and we're saving, we're getting financially prepared, but this is one of the, you know, most powerful levers that we have. I mean, it's the most powerful tactic that we have as workers to actually win concessions from the boss. It's to withhold our labor. And this is something that, you know, pretty much everyone intuitively understands, and a lot of people want to do this. So, you know, I can't speak for the whole country. I can speak basically for like my building in Brooklyn, and it seems like a lot of people do want to go on strike, but it's ultimately going to be up to the members. And I think that if we do go on strike in 2023, what would it mean for the American labor movement? I think it depends on whether or not we win. And I think that if we are successful in a strike in 2023, I mean, this is going to be a huge event, a huge, huge, huge event. I mean, UPS moves 6% of U.S. GDP. So it's going to have an enormous economic impact. It's going to be, you know, front page on like every newspaper while this is happening, because it's going to have such an enormous economic impact. It's going to have an enormous political impact, because you know that Biden is going to get involved, that everyone's going to have to sort of take a stance on this. You know, customers, residents, people aren't going to have their UPS trucks like on the street. There's going to be picket lines. This is going to affect people all over the country. And so if we're able to pull it off and be successful, I think it's going to really push the limits of what people like imagine is possible. And it's going to be super high profile. So I think that it could really, really be an event that, gives the American labor movement a huge burst of energy. And if we can get a very strong contract, it's going to be a very public contract fight. And ultimately, that's what it's going to come down to, is being able to then very publicly show what workers can get when we are unionized, organized, and go that extra mile to actually win a strong contract.
It could make people believe in solidarity and its power on a mass scale. And so there's so much potential with this fight, with the struggle. It's a very interesting fight. You have a contract, a previous contract that was pushed down the throat of the members against their will. You have new leadership that is using the rhetoric of class struggle. You have workers in horrible conditions, working without air conditioning in the heat, that is only going to get worse with climate change. You have a membership that is getting mobilized and holding rallies, turning out and beginning to fight back, preparing for a strike, getting a strike fund together. So you have momentum is building towards this massive action that could be transformative in the American political scene, and we're going to definitely have our eyes on it. But first, we want to turn to a clip from Chris Smalls at a Labor Day rally from this past weekend. So we just have a clip of Chris Smalls at a Labor Day rally. Max, whenever you can play that clip.
Here in the States, you know, we have a systemic issue. You know, we have weak laws, labor laws are weak. The NLRB is underfunded, understaffed. The administration is not doing enough. They're not passing the PRO Act. There's a number of issues in this country. But as organizers, it's up to us to continue to organize. That's all we can do.
And do you feel like Amazon Labor Union is an example for the office?
Absolutely. I mean, we're one of many faces of the movement right now, and I know that our contract fight is very detrimental to the movement. If we win, everybody wins. If we lose, everybody loses. So it's very important.
And last question, what's the next move? What's the next step for you?
We're going to go on strike. We got prepared. We're going on strike, so we're going to get to our strike funds. Support our next campaign in October. Albany, ALB 1. So we want to be right back on the campaign trail. We got other bills that are going to go public as well.
So Chris, tell me what the purpose of today is.
Oh, it's Labor Day. You know, it's a holiday for workers.
But the march.
And today we had to march for recognition because Starbucks Trader Joe's, Amazon, CEOs, corporations all recognize that we won our election.
And tell me what just happened with NLRB and ARU.
A couple days ago, we had some good news that we won our court hearing after spending several weeks in court. They made a verdict that they recommend that we get certified as a bona fide union. We're happy that we are able to share that celebratory moment, but we know that they're going to appeal, so we have to just continue to be ready.
Okay, anything else you want the audience to know?
Donate to our strike lines, Amazon.org. Come on, one last question. Here we are. Get ready to quote. I'm sorry. Very excited about it because, the workers are proving that they're resilient, finally upstate New York and very South County. Just proving that the unions and union efforts are reaching the max.
Last question, General Strike 2024.
I'm calling for it. As a union president, I'm taking a stance, and I think that we all should do it.
Are you guys going to get ready over the next couple of years?
We're going to get ready now. Of course.
So that was Chris Smalls from Amazon Labor Union, and you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today we're talking with Matt about the Teamsters, their struggle against UPS for a fair contract, the long history of the Teamsters' struggles across the U.S., including the UPS strike in 1997, and whether there could be a strike in 2023. And before we get back to our conversation with Matt, I just want to let our listeners know that we have about 10 minutes left of the show, so we'd love at this time for you to call in and talk to us. Please give us a call at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. So while we wait to get calls from listeners, Matt, I just want to ask you, we just heard from Chris Smalls from the Amazon Labor Union. How are the struggles of workers at Amazon and UPS connected, and how can socialists get involved in these fights?
Yeah, it's a super important question. I mean, I think that one way that I like to think about it is that it's super, super important that we, think outside just the categories of, the companies, right? We need to think about what role these workers are playing in the economy. And the question, the answer is basically workers at Amazon and workers at UPS, the logistics workers perform a very, very similar role in the economy. UPS drivers and Amazon drivers basically do the same thing, serve the same sort of economic, social function as do the workers in the Amazon warehouses and the UPS warehouses. Even if the nature of the work looks a little bit different, these workers play a very similar role in the economy. And so the fact that, UPS workers earn a pension, earn twice as much in wages, have very solid health care, set schedules, basically just working conditions that, working paying conditions that are much better, we have to think about it just in terms of why do these workers who perform a very, very similar role in the economy, why are they able to, purchase a home and have this job as a career and then retire with it? Whereas workers at Amazon are not able to do this. And of course, the answer is that workers at UPS are organized in a union and workers at Amazon are not. And so, with the clip that you played of Chris Smalls, it's what these guys are doing with the Amazon Labor Union is truly historic. And it's not only, like he was saying, it's not only good for Amazon workers if they win. It's also actually good for UPS workers if they win, because we want to see union density in the industry increasing, because the more organized that workers are in the industry, the more that workers performing these jobs have power to actually fight for better conditions, the easier it's going to be for workers to get these conditions, regardless of what company that they work for. So it's important not only for Amazon workers, but for UPS workers as well, and then, of course, for workers across, you know, the economy, across different industries, that this effort succeeds. But precisely, or specifically because we are both workers performing very similar roles in the economy, these struggles are deeply intertwined.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical point. And I think it's in twofold ways, where you have these workers, logistic workers, they're at choke points in the economy. They have the power to shut things down, this potential power, but they only can do that if they're organized, if they have an organization like a union that can solidify their power collectively as workers. An individual worker can't stop the churning of the machine, but workers collectively can. They can exert their power. They can fight for a more democratic society, a society where there's more working class power. And that's what workers at UPS are doing by fighting for a more fair contract. That's what workers at Amazon are doing by fighting to organize a new union. So their struggle is united in many ways. And if they really fuse their struggles, they can flip the balance of power totally in society. And we could imagine a totally indifferent society where it's not capitalists who hold all the cards, but it's workers who are holding the cards, who have the power in this society. Max, do we have any calls?
Yes, we do have one.
All right, great. Well, you are live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name and what's your question and or comment?
Oh, hi, it's Joan. I'm wondering if you think I'm... Many years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, there was a strike in Paris. Maybe you remember. It was the metro, the underground, the subway system. And the whole system stopped. The workers were on strike. They got great support from all the people, even though the people were greatly inconvenienced. You know, they had to put on their running shoes and their walking shoes and walk to work for a very long time. But I think the reason that the workers had the support of all the Parisians, as inconvenient as it was that they weren't just fighting for their own union. I think in America, unions tend to lose support because they go on strike and they say, we want benefits for us, for our union, from our company. Whereas what they do in France, they say, we want a 35-hour work week for everyone, or we want health benefits for everyone in the whole country. And American unions tend not to do that. And I think if they did that, like, we want single-payer health care for everyone, not just a good deal for us who happen to work for UPS or Amazon or whatever, for everyone. And then they would get tremendous support from the whole country. What do you think?
I think that's a very compelling point, and I'll let Matt add on to that. But I think what you've seen, I think we've seen this recently from teachers across the country in the organizing for the common good model, where you have teachers going on strike and they're not just fighting for higher wages, but they're fighting for more investment in the schools. They're fighting for housing rights, for immigrant rights. They're fighting for lower class sizes. They're equating working conditions as learning conditions. So they're doing this not just by saying these demands, but actually organizing alongside parents and students and building a movement for greater resources and more investment in public education and in the investment in the society as a whole. So we do see American unions in recent examples, the most powerful demonstrations of class struggle, the teacher strikes in Chicago and Los Angeles and West Virginia, all across the country in 2018 and 2019, even dating back to 2012. So we do have examples of this. But I think we also see the Teamsters doing this by standing and going to rallies with Bernie Sanders, connecting the leadership of the Teamsters, connecting their movement to the movement for democratic socialism. So, Matt, add on something real quick. We just have one more caller.
Sure. Real quick, I'll just add that, I mean, I think it's different in France than it is in the U.S. in terms of labor law, that we can't do secondary strikes. And so I think it's harder to have, like, coordinated work stoppages between different unions, because different unions have contracts that with expiration dates that don't necessarily overlap. So, like, if the Teamsters go on strike and, I don't know, some other union, like, is in the middle of their contract with a no-strike clause, they can't necessarily just like strike to support, you know, a victory with the Teamsters, and the Teamsters can't necessarily strike to support, you know, like a union fight for other workers.
That's a really great point, Matt. I just want to give our second caller just a second to chime in. You're live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name and what's your question or comment?
Hey, how are you? This is the Italiano from Riverdale. It's a comment. I've been listening to shows just like yours when they talk about unionizing and things like this. It's great about Starbucks and Amazon and increasing unions for sure. But these are two non, you know, industry or product. These are two non-producing, pretty much companies. Well, they make coffee, one of them. So it would be great to hear about manufacturing unions and things like this, and companies that actually, how are they doing? And I got some information on someone who predicted that. So my suggestion would be focus in on the millennials and Generation Z, because they're not into unions, pretty much for the most part, as a convention. You know, I'm not talking about the exceptions.
I'm not sure about that. Millennials and Gen Z have a very favorable opinion of unions. If you do polling, they would like to be in unions. They've just been living in a society where unions.
You mean all the office workers? All the people who do white collar jobs?
It's not just white collar jobs. There's people doing all kinds of jobs: service workers, logistic workers, people working in warehouses. Like the Amazon workers are working in a warehouse, and they're a key part of the economy. But you also have you have healthcare workers that are looking to unionize. It's all spread across the economy. And if we just focus on manufacturing, which is about 8% of U.S. employment, then we're not going to organize the entire working class. So manufacturing is a key part of it. We had somebody from the UAW on our show back in December. But we have to but thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. We have to wrap up the show. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute. We'll see you out organizing your workplace, organizing your building, organizing out on the streets. This is Revolution Minute with Jack Devine. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back in 2 weeks.